This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, April 20th, 2023. I'm Caleb Brown. Is the solution to stemming the tide of dangerous levels of federal debt making the process look more like the congressional process for shifting and closing military bases? Cato's Romina Baccia and William Glass of the Millennial Debt Foundation discuss how best to move the needle on reining in U.S. debt in a rational and, importantly, politically palatable way. William, let's start with you. Tell us about the Millennial Debt Foundation.
The Millennial Debt Foundation was started by the current Hamilton County Mayor, Weston Womp, in league with one of his mentors, the late Senator Tom Coburn. And it was basically the fruit of Tom Coburn's career-long warning to the country about the debt and who was likely to have to deal with the fallout and the consequences if the debt was not brought under more control. And so Weston began to discover that it would be our generation, millennials, that were going to bear or eat the twisted fruit of this problem. And as we began to talk about it and gather our commissioners and the people who've worked with us on this project, we realized we had a solidarity in this. A lot of us were concerned about this. A lot of us realized that we were going to live in an economy that was going to increasingly crowd out our ability to do good. It was going to crowd out opportunity, and it was going to harm, most of all, the people who need the government's help the most over the next 30, 40 years. They were going to be harmed most of all by a runaway debt and irresponsible fiscal policy. So that's how the foundation was started. We decided we wanted to gather millennials to start a discussion and then actually move the needle on the issue. And that's how we started.
What does moving the needle look like in practice? Because for all of the discussions that I've seen or heard, it seems that not much really moves the needle on this issue.
Yeah, that's a fair point. There's a couple ways to think about it, I think. One is, I mean, obviously, you know, if I could wave a magic wand over my scenario, our leaders would actually act. They would act meaningfully on this. And that's not something that no one has proposed a way to do. There's lots of options if we have the will to do it. Secondarily, in the event that we just remain possessed of leaders who refuse to take up serious action about this, then what Millennial Debt Foundation can do is provide a kind of a way forward when the issue does become impossible to ignore. Unfortunately, it will cost us a lot more than it will hurt a lot more people. But if we can be there as a sign of what to do next, whenever it becomes impossible to do nothing, that will be less success than we want, but that may be what there is. So moving the needle is essentially, it's policy being enacted by leaders who we sent to go to Washington and do responsible things on the people's behalf. That's what moving the needle is.
Romina, you wrote recently on the Cato blog sort of detailing the proposals of the Millennial Debt Foundation, at listing them as, you know, reforms millennials can, should, ought to get behind. Could you walk us through a few of those?
Yes. So most importantly, the Millennial Debt Foundation tackles the biggest drivers of growing spending and debt. That's Medicare and Social Security. And when I say biggest drivers, according to the Treasury Financial Report, 95% of U.S. government unfunded obligations over the next 75 years are driven by just these two programs. So to make any difference in our long-term debt trajectory, you have to tackle Social Security and Medicare. But the changes that the foundation recommends are very sensible. They focus benefits on those beneficiaries who need them the most, and focus changes to things like a reduction in the growth in benefits, making benefits less generous for higher income earners, on those individuals who can bear to do with less. There was actually a really interesting letter to the editor in the New York Times recently, where a couple wrote that they collect $40,000 a year from Social Security. Meanwhile, they have a seven-figure net worth, and it only makes sense to means test it. They don't need the money. And certainly they understand that this is contributing to our debt crisis. So it's those kinds of reforms. They tackle a lot of bad taxes. So for example, the employer exclusion for healthcare that is one of the primary drivers of healthcare cost growth. It's this third-party payer system that distorts incentives. And so overall, those 10 recommendations make a key difference in the long-term debt trajectory, reducing it significantly by 50 percentage points over 30 years, which is big, and doing all of that by protecting benefits for the most vulnerable and cutting where it makes the most sense.
William, one of your proposals is to extend the cap on the SALT deduction.
Yes.
This is not being met with zero opposition. There are members of Congress in both New York and California, surprise, surprise, who are interested in getting rid of the cap as it has been before 2017.
Yes, it's very nice for people in wealthy states to have their all of their state perks subsidized by the people in poor states. That's a really great benefit. Who wouldn't want that?
I was wondering, you know, I've spoken with other scholars on the subject. What about just repealing the 16th Amendment? Would that have an effect on the demand for new spending from the federal level?
I'm not going to walk into that. That's another story for another day. I think the thing that I want to say about what MDF is up to is that we're dealing with realistic proposals. We don't need to have 3/4 majority of the country and then ratified by 3/4 of the states in order to make the kind of changes that can actually make a serious difference in the problem. We actually are not dealing with an intractable issue. We're dealing with a little bit of an education issue, a little bit of a bad comms issue, and we've hired people who are incentivized to ignore this problem. Everything but these two entitlements that Romina mentioned a few minutes ago is a rounding error. Everything else that we can touch, if we don't touch those, we can fix literally everything else and it will not matter. So this is an issue where there's a critical need to get good education to the public and also to our leaders and to the 25-year-olds who run the world from their bosses' offices. That there's a way forward on this. There's real possibility. I think this is a winnable fight, and that's the Tom Coburn legacy for us, is that this is a fight we can win. There are things we can do. We may not have to be able to do all of it at once, but we can make incremental progress, and so we don't have to repeal a constitutional amendment in order to make this work.
Romina, with respect to spending cuts now or spending cuts later, it was either a calculation that you pointed me to, it might have been yours, I can't recall at the moment, but the idea was the trade-off between big spending cuts now and resuming our normal regular rate of growth, or reducing spending over time by smaller fractions. Which do you prefer? Which do you think is more politically saleable?
You know, I think the strategy that the House is employing right now makes sense. We need some immediate spending cuts to get lawmakers in the habit of this is what's needed now. But then for some of the biggest programs, Medicare, Social Security being the prime targets here, it's really difficult to make big changes because so many people do rely on them in retirement. And to the degree that we can make big changes, they would need to be focused on the highest income earners that can bear those. But I think overall, politically, it's just not feasible not to gradually phase in entitlement reform. I think that's going to be necessary unless we are in a major financial crisis and lawmakers are forced to make those changes. But that's the exact scenario that we want to avoid. Cutting discretionary spending right away, cutting down government programs and agencies back to size, returning more responsibilities to the states and localities that can best represent the interests of their constituents. All of those are changes we can make immediately. And then importantly, phasing in changes to healthcare programs and other old age entitlements like Social Security. Those will have to happen more gradually. But as William pointed out, if we don't tackle those, there's almost nothing else matters.
It seems like we have one party that is broadly not super interested in reducing spending. We have another party that says they're interested in reducing spending, and whenever they get in power, they bust the bank. And we have age cohorts in America that, as they age and are more likely to be collecting benefits from the feds just so happens they're also much more likely to vote.
That's right.
It's not really, you hit the nail on the head. Go ahead.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And I think that's why we need this exact process that the Millennial Debt Foundation used to arrive at their 10 proposals in Congress. I think Congress should stand up an independent commission staffed with outside experts picked by both parties that put together a reform proposal that tackles Medicare and Social Security, makes sure that both programs are solvent over the next 75 years at a minimum, and stabilizes the debt in the process. Debt is at almost 100% of GDP, which is everything the economy produces in goods and services in a given year. That is too high. That is dragging down growth now. But I don't think politicians, like you pointed out, will tackle these problems by themselves responsibly. So they need to be insulated from the political risk. And I think that's where an independent commission can be most helpful.
The parallel has been drawn between this and BRAC, which is the base realignment and closings system that was established in the 2010s, seemed to work pretty well, which is to say the goals are clear, the group has a clear mandate, and then it's an up or down vote in Congress. Mm-hmm. For the package of reforms to our bases. So it sounds promising in the sense that there's a way to take politics out of it. Every member of Congress in that situation gets one really hard vote instead of getting hammered over and over and over again on smaller votes to reduce spending. So how are these members selected for the group that you suggest?
Yes, I'm really, really glad that Romina mentioned the nonpartisan commission. She's been advocating for that in writing. And I think she's actually drawn the comparison to BRAC explicitly several times in her own writing. I'm grateful for that, because that is exactly, that is how we've thought about this too. The idea is to get subject matter experts together. And initially, this is one of our, I think one of the most exciting things about the Millennial Debt Foundation is that it's not a beltway 501c3 or C4. It is not. It was originated by people having a conscience about the issue, as those who were going to be responsible to see it solved, those who were going to end up paying this back, both themselves in their own pocketbooks and in their own wallets, but also most of us who are part of the foundation are responsible for employees who are not positioned as well as us, maybe socioeconomically, and are going to pay more of a cost. So it's out of a sense of conscience that a bunch of non-politicians got together most of whom were entrepreneurs that were just running in the same network. And together we realized this is an issue that's not going to just hamper the wealthy among us, we are going to be fine, actually. No matter what happens, we're going to pivot and be fine. Who's not going to be fine is people who are walking up an opportunity ladder right now. Who's not going to be fine are people who depend upon the government when indiscriminate cuts have to happen because we wouldn't make them in time. And so our foundation was a bunch of entrepreneurs who realized that our own employees' lives were going to be at stake, and we wanted to do something about it. And then as we began to gather, what's unique is entrepreneurs know entrepreneurs. So we would pull each other in. And what I think is amazing is that 95% of those people, myself included, had voted before, but had never been seriously involved in politics before, precisely because we find politics to be so intractable, precisely because it seems like nothing can ever get done. But this way forward, especially that Romina has been advocating for in her writing recently, we see that as the way forward too, that we need non-lawmakers to be gathering and participating in a discussion, contributing subject matter expertise to make very, very clear to everybody who has a vote to cast what's going to happen if this doesn't get better quickly. And then give them a bonded proposal that says, this is one thing, one yes, one no. Do you want millennial citizens? Do you want their children? Do you want their aging grandparents to be beaten up by harangued from the pillar of inflation to the post of recession or not?
So to both of you then, with respect to Congress and its power of the purse What does the next 5 years look like in your view? And what are you hopeful can be achieved?
Yeah, one thing that we noticed that is opening a window of opportunity potential for Medicare reform, which is the most important reform. If we're going to reform just one program, Medicare should be the one. And the president, even though over his State of the Union, he was being very negative about potential changes to Medicare and Social Security, following that, he actually released a budget where he put forth a number of proposals on Medicare. And while I'm not too excited about the actual details, which are primarily price controls on drugs and more taxes, higher taxes, particularly on small businesses and entrepreneurs, I think the fact that the president is putting forth any proposal to say, you know, Medicare is running out of money, there will be automatic benefit cuts, we want to avoid those. I think that creates an opportunity to say, okay, what reforms can we work on together? So one area right now is to say, okay, if benefit cuts are off the table, what are some administrative and bureaucratic reforms that introduce more market forces into Medicare that can help reduce costs while actually increasing the quality of the services delivered for seniors? And there's a whole range of proposals that are also in the Millennial Debt Foundation plan that I think conservatives and libertarians and progressives should be able to get behind if we can all just be sensible and say that, you know, the way Medicare works right now, it doesn't actually work that well. We shouldn't pretend that doing nothing is the best option. There are better options on the table, and now is the time to make those changes because Medicare's trust fund will run out of money by 2028. That's only 5 years down the road. So we have to do something, so let's do something productive.
William, we call Medicare and Social Security entitlements, but it's a bit of a lie. In the sense that nobody's actually entitled to any of it. It's largely a transfer program, and your entitlement to it is based on Congress's ability and desire to fund it.
Yes, that's correct. But I think it's worth saying that, I mean, that in general, especially in the generation of people who are nearing and coming near to retirement now, that when it comes to entitlement, the marketing of entitlement was your permission to allow us to garnish this bit of your wages and your earning power over the course of your entire life is going to be bargained off by then a return that you are quote unquote entitled to later. But most people, especially those retiring now, are going to spend nearly a third of their lives being funded by these programs. And I, from what I can see, the average dollar amount is nearly 2 or 3 to 1 in terms of what they've paid in and what they're getting back. So it seems to me that entitlement is a misnomer. If anything, it's turning into a massive vehicle for the transfer of wealth from the middle class to the wealthy.
William Glass is with the Millennial Debt Foundation. Romina Baccia directs budget and entitlement policy at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.